Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Neil Ward, and I'm grateful that you are taking time out of your day to learn more about design educators' paths to tenure. I truly appreciate it. On this episode of Tell It to Neil, we are chatting with Assistant Professor of Graphic Design Jared Elrod from the University of Florida in Gainesville, Florida. Let's listen in. Hey, Jared, how are you?
I'm doing well, Neil. How's it going?
Pretty good. Thank you for joining us on Tell It to Neil.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get started here. So, how did you get into the design field?
You know, I've told this story to a lot of different people and pretty much the same way every time. I definitely contribute it a lot to luck and being around the right people at the right time. And of course having a really supportive family. But, you know, it started out like, if you've read Paul Sayer's book, Two Dimensional Man, very similar. When I was a kid, I was just drawing all the time. I loved to draw. I didn't really know why, but I used to just stay up all night and try to replicate things that I would see. And, you know, when I was a kid, it was usually, you know, the basic stuff that you would want to draw, like jets and motorcycles. And, you know, I went through like a Dragon Ball Z phase and all that stuff. But I was just constantly drawing, and I still have some notebooks from when I was in school, and they're all filled with little drawings of trucks and anime and things that say I hate school over and over again, which is ironic because I signed up for so much extra school and now I work at a school. But it started with just a love to draw, and then a visit to the high school counselor's office in the really small town that I grew up in that said, oh, you like to draw, well, you should think of graphic design. I didn't know what graphic design was. I'd heard of the term. You know, I was 18. I wasn't really thinking about the future very much. I applied to one college. You know.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Texas Panhandle in a really small town called Borger, Texas, B-O-R-G-E-R. And it's close to Amarillo. So if you've ever driven through Texas on I-40, it is the part of the Texas Panhandle that has the big Texas steakhouse where they have the 72-ounce steak. Anybody that's ever been through there, that's how they know it. Oh yeah, you have that 72-ounce steak. I was like, yeah, that's pretty much right. But so I grew up in Borger, Texas, about 12,000 people. It's a big oil and gas kind of hub, refineries and stuff there. Most of my family works in that industry. And I went to college at West Texas A&M University for undergrad, where I got my BFA in graphic design. So I had that visit, probably a 5 to 10 minute visit with the counselor at high school, said, hey, you should think about graphic design. All my friends were going to college for engineering. I'm a pretty competitive person. So I'm like, well, if my friends are going to go to college, this makes me sound really horrible, but it's like, if my friends are going to go to college, I should probably go to college. And I actually ended up rooming with, who's still one of my best friends, my roommate Jay, who I lived with for 3 years, who also went to West Texas A&M University as part of a pre-admitted medical school program with Texas A&M University, because West Texas A&M was a satellite school. He actually just got his first job as a doctor, but as you can imagine, being pre-admitted to medical school, he was very driven, really intelligent, really well-spoken. I was always intuitively intelligent. I could draw and had skills, but that was really the first time I was ever around somebody that really cared about what they were doing with academic work. And, it was really dedicated to that kind of thing. And I think that kind of my natural competitive drive kind of, you know, pushed me to do what he was doing. And I really, even though we were the same age, he was kind of a really big role model for me because, you know, I kind of like to fly by the seat of my pants, and I was really intuitive. And here was this person that I was living with that was really dedicated and cared about grades. And that kind of naturally translated into, you know, to my academic coursework, you know, during my 4 years at West Texas A&M University. So that was another person, my roommate, that really kind of helped me along and was, you know, in the right place at the right time. And
it's good to have some friendly competition.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so there was that. But West Texas A&M was a small school. I only had basically one professor for each area. So like painting and drawing, graphic design, printmaking and digital art. There was kind of one person for that. And I had an amazing graphic design professor. I still I still talk to him all the time. He's retired, but his name is Bob Carruthers, and he's an amazing illustrator. His office was, I remember the first time walking into his office, it was just covered in posters, and he had stuff all over the place and awards, and I could just go in there and talk to him for 2 or 3 hours. And even when I signed up for graphic design at, you know, the first 2 years at a 4-year institution is usually core work, you know, 2D design, 3D design, drawing yep. classes. Even going through the first 2 years, I still really had no idea what graphic design actually was until I started taking courses with Bob and actually going to his office and talking to him and looking at what was up on his walls and what he was showing me. And he was a really influential figure for a lot of different ways because he recommended me for my first internship, which turned into a job at an advertising agency in Amarillo, which was close to Canyon, which is where West Texas A&M was. And he also showed me letterpress and talked to me about what was then Yeehaw Industries in Knoxville, Tennessee, which became Church of Type in Santa Monica. And now I think it's going back to Johnson City, but I can't remember the name, but it's Kevin Bradley and his partner at the time, Julie, in Knoxville, Tennessee, Yeehaw Industries. Bob showed me Yeehaw, showed me letterpress. I was doing my own little letterpress experiments, you know, relief printing for projects. And then he talked to me about graduate school one day, much like the counseling center, or the not the counseling center, but the counselor in high school. You know, hey, have you thought about graphic design? Bob was like, hey, have you thought about graduate school? It's like, no, I haven't, but maybe I should because I like you and I trust you. So, and, you know, I was working at an advertising agency. I'd already had over 3 years under my belt full time, or like 30 hours a week by the time I graduated, because there were a lot of opportunities because it wasn't really a big market. So I got my foot in the door really early. And by the time I graduated undergrad, I mean, I was doing presentations for clients and going to work in suits sometimes, and we would present to banks, and I was pretty well seasoned by the time I finished, you know, undergrad. And I was already starting to feel a little burnt out and a little kind of tired of doing that. Like the initial excitement of, you know, doing a billboard or, you know, whatever, had kind of worn off, and I kind of started to see beyond that. And I started thinking about, you know, sustainability and, you know, the value and the ethical, you know, side of what I was doing, especially for clients that I didn't really care to work for, mainly banks and telecommunications companies. Those were my two least favorite things to work on, and started to think about, like, maybe there's more to this than just advertising and being in an advertising agency for the rest of my career. And when Bob showed me letterpress and I started experimenting with that, then he showed me University of Tennessee and talked to me about applying to graduate school. I ended up applying to a couple of different places, and University of Tennessee offered me a graduate teaching assistantship. And, at the time, once again, I was totally ignorant. I didn't even know what that was. I was like, well, okay, that's, they were like, oh, we're going to offer you a graduate teaching assistantship. And I was like, that's great. What is it? And there was like a pause on the other end of the line for like 5 seconds. And they kind of explained, you know, what that meant. And I was like, yeah, sign me up for that. That's what I want. So once again, I, you know, went to graduate school, and it was a radically different method of design education than what I went through at West Texas A&M University, because it was a small program. It was very intuitive. In Tennessee, they were teaching kind of Bauhaus principles, you know, for sophomores, and the approach to design education and research was totally different than anything I'd been exposed to. So I really had to kind of relearn. I mean, I knew how to get to the destination, but I did it in a very different way than they did it. And it was kind of shocking at first, but it was really great for me to have to relearn with kind of a different language. So really, honestly, to answer that question, I just, again, right place, right time, right people that cared about me, and, you know, just tried to put out positive vibes and be nice to people. And I try not to burn bridges. And that's been something that's really helped with my career trajectory. That was a long answer to your question. Sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay. We have time. So now kind of two questions off of that, or maybe a couple more. At what point during your schooling or your industry experience, did it kind of click with you that you might want to be a design educator?
I could actually trace that back to one specific project, and I can't say that it was the moment in time that I said I want to become a teacher. I could tell a story about that too, and I can get to that. But the moment in time that I realized that I needed more out of design and wanted and knew that there was more out there was I was working on a piece of direct mail for a telecommunications company that was a big client of ours. So it was a big client of ours, telecommunications company. It was a piece of direct mail. I was working on it. And you know, telecommunications companies, like especially big ones like Comcast, they're kind of universally hated. They're not great with customer service. And while this was kind of a local regional company, they had a reputation for just being a really crappy company. And I knew that, and I'd used their services before. And we were making this stuff that definitely didn't align with what their actual services were like. So I started feeling pretty bad about that. And like I said earlier, the initial kind of excitement of like making things and getting them approved and working with clients had kind of worn off. And I remember sitting there thinking about, like, I was doing the print estimate and we were going to print like 20,000 or 30,000 of these things. And I was thinking about what I do with mail when I get it, like direct mail when I get it, is I just throw it in the trash. And, you know, at a lot of places, you know, they recycle and stuff like that, which is great. But when I was growing up in West Texas, even in the early 2000s when I was working at this agency, there's no recycling. There's still not really any recycling there. So I was thinking about just all of this stuff that's going to get thrown away, and I just really got kind of fed up with it. And at the same time, there was a lot of turnover in my office. It was a partnership, and we had a satellite office, and the partners were fighting with each other, and it just really...
Well, that's not good.
No, it was really kind of a bummer environment, and I was only... I think I was 20 or 21, and even already then, I was like, I can't see myself doing this for 10 more years. I gotta make a change. And this was about the time when I was finishing undergrad and doing a lot of experimentation and learning about what else was out there, and I'd never lived outside of the kind of Texas Panhandle area, and while I didn't know what it would be like, what was that?
About what time frame was this?
This is my senior year of undergrad, so I was, that would be 2007, 2006, okay. And you know, I didn't know what it would be like to move away. I just kind of knew that I wanted to, and of course, it ended up being a pretty big deal because it was Texas to Tennessee, which is not really a huge. I didn't think it would be a huge deal, but then I started looking at how many miles it would be and how long it would take me to drive there and what it would mean to be that far away and how long it would even take to fly because of the connecting flights. And it started becoming very real. You know, as I said earlier, I didn't know what a graduate teaching assistantship was. And when they said that you'll have to teach a class for us to pay your tuition, I was like, yeah, I'll do that. And I didn't really give it a whole lot of thought because I was accepting this offer and I'll work with that later on down the road. And of course, as teaching became closer, it was never something that I thought I would want to do. And I was really pretty terrified, but after the first week of teaching my first class, I knew that I liked it. It was an exciting experience. And the thing that I liked most about it, and the thing I still like most about it, was being around the students and being around people that are excited to learn things. And you know, the moment when you have something really good to say and you realize that a student hasn't had that knowledge yet or and is willing to hear that, is like ready for you to share information with them, is still really exciting for me. Like, well, let me tell you about typography. I mean, because I'm a huge typography dork and I can talk about that stuff all day and as long as people are willing to listen. And I love being in a classroom with people that are excited to learn. I like that it changes every year. It's really great to kind of to keep you out of a rut. And I think that, you know, a big part of life is learning to stay out of ruts and to keep things interesting and to keep changing things and to keep rethinking things. And, the ability to do that and to kind of innovate and kind of rethink how you teach classes based on information and experience and research is really exciting to me. So, you know, I knew that I wanted to be a teacher after that first class, and I thought it could be a viable career path. And because I'm in a kind of a dual career partnership with my spouse, you know, I've been in a situation before where, you know, I had a job offer back at a firm, or I could do like adjunct teaching and freelance on the side. And even though the money would have been better at the firm, there was always this kind of intuitive kind of drive to teach because of, you know, being able to interface with students, but also to have the flexibility. And there was just some kind of pull there that always kind of pulled me in that direction. Even when I had opportunities to get out of teaching.
It's not a bad gig.
Definitely not a bad gig.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but if you were coming from Texas and you went to Tennessee, you pretty much went from orange to orange, right?
Well, you know, West Texas A&M was a Texas A&M school, so we were maroon. But you're talking about the University of Texas, which is orange, but that's going to be a burnt orange. You know, people get mad at me when I'm in Austin because I still have some Tennessee stuff. Oh, dude, that's not the real UT. Of like, dude, Tennessee was there like 100 years before your school. So,
yes.
gonna have to give you a hard no on that one. But now, University of Texas at Austin's a really great school. It's a really fun town. If you've ever had a chance to go there before, I'd recommend it if you haven't.
I will have to do that. I haven't been there yet.
But as you know, University of Tennessee is definitely not a burnt orange, a very bright highlighter orange. Yeah. Like hunting orange.
Almost.
Almost, yeah.
So you were at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, for your MFA degree. And what type of work were you doing there?
Yes, so that was a major transition for me moving to Tennessee. I did have a graduate teaching assistantship. I assisted in graphic design classes as part of my assistantship the first year, and then the second and third years I taught in the Foundations program. So primarily I taught a time-based media class called Intro to 4D, which I really kind of fell in love with and really enjoyed teaching. Another part of my assistantship, which kind of got added on, which is why I wanted to go there, was to help run the University of Tennessee letterpress shop. So myself and Hillary, another graduate student that was in my cohort, were asked to kind of help start collecting type. We had a big donation from somebody, and printmaking was donating another press that they had, and we were putting together basically a small print shop with two letterpresses, a Challenge Proofing Press and a Vandercook SP15, and they asked us to organize type and kind of get the presses going and start running workshops and open hours as part of our assistantship. And you know, they offered us money to do it, and it was fantastic. And I spent 2 years doing that. I loved every minute of it. I still think about it, actually. You know, my work day used to involve, and I did it in the evening from like 5:30 to 9 or 6 to 9 or something, basically involved going into a letterpress shop and listening to music and talking to people and like showing them how to print and making jokes. And it was a really great time, and it really helped that the letterpress shop was literally about 10 steps from my my studio, which was a fantastic setup. And like many graduate programs, I was taking elective coursework in different areas outside of graphic design and inside graphic design. Graphic design seminars the first 2 years, and then a thesis, which lasted the full third year. And that was where my research interest in design process, or to be more specific, the experience of design process, really kind of started to take shape. And like many things in my life, it really happened intuitively, and I didn't know that it was taking shape until after my thesis show was really kind of over and I started trying to kind of reflect on what had happened and what worked about it and what didn't. And I'm still doing that today. I mean, I've been out of graduate school almost 10 years now, and I'm still thinking back to that year and making connections that I didn't really get during that year based on the research that I'm doing now and the work I'm doing with my spouse, who is a performance psychologist. So a big part of what I'm doing for research right now is incorporating or applying mental skills training, more specifically mindfulness-based practice, to the design process to both facilitate alternative ways to ideate for projects and also to increase mental toughness and resiliency in getting from point A to point B in a process. And I should have my spouse here to talk about that more specifically as the expert in that area.
It sounds really interesting, and I would love to know more. And I'm sure you're going to be presenting at, I don't know, UCDA or CCAC or something like that, a conference like that in the future.
Yes, we have done a few presentations at a few conferences. This year, this academic year, we presented at two conferences, two national conferences, which was great. We did a project together with one of my classes. I'm working to see if I can teach a graduate seminar that would basically be a full semester where we would partner for a full semester with graduate students to kind of see how we could grow the work and kind of explore other areas of how we could apply facets of performance psychology to design process to create more unique outcomes.
Well, I wish you luck in that, and I hope it pans out.
Thank you. So do I. So far, so good.
Yeah. Well, so after graduation, you mentioned that was about 10 years ago, you needed to kind of take the next step and find a job. So walk us through, like, what's been happening in the past 10 years?
Oh, man. So you thought the answer to the first question was long. This one's probably really about to be long because a lot has happened in the 10 years since I finished graduate school. And a lot of it, and I wouldn't change anything if I had to go back. I'll just preface this before I start this journey. I'll preface it with that. I wouldn't change a thing. Really, both my partner and I are super happy with where we ended up. But it was a long, winding, and at times difficult journey for both of us to be in a place that we like, doing the type of work that we like. And a lot of it kind of centered around, you know, this idea of a dual career couple. We're both very driven. My spouse is a psychologist. I'm a design educator and a graphic designer. We're both very passionate about what we do. But at the same time, we're both very interested in a lot of other things, and we like to be very busy. But something that really made it tricky for us was that I was going to move back to Texas after graduate school and actually met my spouse my last year of graduate school, and decided to stick around because I was, you know, the relationship was great and I really saw that it had a future. And at the time, you know, I was getting ready to finish. My spouse was pretty much right in the middle of her PhD in psychology, which is not as long as like a full-on medical degree where you go for like 10 years, but I ended up being about probably eight years, I think she did. I mean, I'm probably going to, if she was here right now, she'd probably be not happy about how I'm explaining all this stuff. Basically, it was 5 years of graduate school. It was a 1 year residency, which is a placement program, kind of like a medical school residency, but it's only 1 year instead of 5 years. And then there's 1 year of postdoc hours that you have to do to even qualify to become license eligible to practice as a psychologist. If you don't have your license, you have to practice under somebody else's license. So it's a very long process. And I think she was in her second or third year of just the graduate school when we met and I was finishing. So she had a couple more years in Tennessee. We got a great little house together in South Knoxville, which is now exploding. If you've been there recently, it's crazy. Knoxville's like the whole town is exploding. It's amazing. Hello, Knoxville, by the way. But so I decided to start looking for work locally, and I found a job at Pellissippi State University or Pellissippi State Community College. So I mentioned earlier that before we got on that my first teaching job outside of graduate school was at a community college, and Pellissippi State's a large community college right outside of Knoxville. I taught there for 2 years. Really felt fortunate to get a job teaching right out of graduate school. I love the people I work with. They were really caring. The students were fantastic. I really enjoyed my time there. there was less of a research expectation. It was more about teaching and kind of running the school, which, you know, I'm very passionate about teaching. A part of my research is still about teaching and pedagogy. And so that was a good fit for me. The only downside was, you know, there was pay. You know, the pay could have been higher. I don't think that it was necessarily sustainable for like real growth trajectory. When you start at a low wage, it's really hard to end up getting paid a lot over the course of a career, because if you start low, you're getting raises in small increments, which means that you're going to stay paid low for the rest of your career, basically. So, you know, I was really enjoying teaching there. I knew that maybe it wasn't going to be, you know, the forever job, because my spouse was finishing her PhD, and then Texas Tech University actually recruited me for a visiting position, and they basically offered me double the salary I was making at Pellissippi State, and I had [S2] Wow. [S1] An opportunity to work with somebody that is still a great friend and I care about and admire, and was one of my top inspirations in undergrad. His name's [S2] Mm. [S1] Dirk Fowler, and he's a letterpress artist that works at Texas Tech, and I had an opportunity to go work with him for a year, and it meant a year of distance. My spouse was going to be finishing mm-hmm. her PhD coursework in Tennessee. I'd be yep. in Lubbock, Texas, which is near my family in West Texas, which was also a draw because I'd been living away from home for a while. And I got to work with Dirk, and, you know, it was an amazing opportunity, and the pay was really great. Not quite double, but pretty close to double.
How did that opportunity come about? Like, did someone just pick up a phone and be like, "Hey, Jared, come work with us"? Or was there a little more networking involved? Or
there was networking, because because Dirk was such an inspiration. He actually came to West Texas A&M when I was there and lectured and showed posters, and of course I was like right up at the table afterwards asking him questions and talking about it. Dirk had actually gone to West Texas A&M also, Bob being the common thread there once again, the guy that I mentioned earlier, facilitated a relationship. We all went out to lunch together. So he had been kind of following what I was doing. We stayed in contact through graduate school. So I had developed a relationship with him over time. And he knew that I was starting my career in teaching. And he also knew that I know what it's like to live in West Texas. It's not, living in West Texas is not easy for a lot of people, especially if you grow up around water and trees. Lubbock and Borger, the area I grew up in, is like being at the ocean, but if the ocean were dirt. It's just flat, it's desolate, it's beautiful at times and treacherous at times, because there are dirt storms, they call them haboobs. You can look it up.
Oh, geez.
So, yeah, just look it up, you'll see. It's a beautiful place at times, and it can be a harsh place at times. But he knew that I could live. I knew what it was like to live in West Texas. He knew I had family, and when I explained when I was leaving Pellissippi, I had family there. They were really gracious about it. It was really sad to leave after just 2 years there, but it was definitely networking and connections and kind of the maintenance of those relationships over the years. And I did the visiting position there. My spouse and I did the distance. So once she finished her coursework, I was finishing my visiting year at Texas Tech University. It was time for her to go on internship, which, as I mentioned before, was a placement-based program. And she was actually placed at the University of Florida. So you select universities, you rank on a list, and then you match. It's called a matching process. And she matched at the University of Florida, not placed, I'm sorry. But she matched there, and Florida, the idea of moving to Florida was really exciting for me. I mean, I had maybe an opportunity to stay at Texas Tech. One thing I did know is that I definitely didn't want to do distance for more than a year. My spouse wasn't interested in that either. She had to go to Florida, and I thought the idea of Florida sounded really exotic, so we both took off to Gainesville, which is actually where we're at now. But I'll get back to that a little bit later.
Yeah.
So we did our year in Gainesville. My spouse did her internship at the counseling center on campus and met a lot of great people. We loved Gainesville our first time around. It's beautiful here. We love the university. It's really diverse. There's a big international presence. The city's very progressive. A lot of biking and hiking and paddle boarding, and we're outdoor people. So it was a really good fit for us. Job-wise,
amazing.
It is amazing. Job-wise for me, it was definitely a hustle year. So I basically started cold emailing programs in Gainesville at the University of Florida, and then in other surrounding towns. And oddly enough, my program coordinator, her name was Carla Tedeschi, or is Carla Tedeschi, still at Texas Tech University. Who I didn't know before I started at Texas Tech. I loved her. She's a fantastic program coordinator and an amazing person. She had actually worked at University of North Texas with Maria Rogal, who is the program coordinator at University of Florida, whenever I came the first time. And she's just finishing a sabbatical here now. But Carla actually called in a good word for me with Maria. And when I got here, I was interviewing for jobs, working for like UF as a graphic designer, working in the community as a graphic designer, working at an art gallery. I had job offers from an art gallery and from a part of the campus that had graphic designers, and then I had this offer to teach some adjunct mm-hmm. courses. And as I mentioned earlier, that kind of draw to keep teaching and stay in the university culture really kind of pulled me, and I accepted the position to do some adjunct teaching at UF. I actually taught at another school that first semester about 30 miles away. So there was a time where I would ride my bike to campus in the morning at UF, teach two classes in typography, ride my bike home as quickly as possible, jump in the car, and go about 30 miles to teach an afternoon class at another small school in Ocala, Florida, called CF, College of Central Florida, and they're an affiliate of UCF in Orlando, and I taught a digital imaging course there in the evening. I did that commute twice a week, which was about a 60-mile round trip on I-75, which was not pleasant, in our car that was like breaking down because everything that we owned at that point was breaking because it was going through lots of moves and it was really old. And as you can imagine, I wasn't making a lot with adjunct teaching and internships. They don't really pay very well either for people going through PhD psychology programs, which is a whole nother topic of discussion. So we were just barely scraping by. It was still a wonderful year. We fell in love with Gainesville. We met a lot of really great people. I got to know Maria really well and really enjoyed working with her and the students, and I got to teach in the studios at UF, which the seniors and the juniors and the grads have dedicated studios, and you get to go teach in the studios, which is fantastic. Wow. I really like doing that. It was this great studio culture. So that was a good year. And then after that year was up, we had to move again because there were no real opportunities, because my spouse was on a one-year internship and I was just adjunct teaching, so there was no summer pay or anything. So we were applying for jobs. I interviewed at a couple of places, didn't get any offers. Thought I was going to get an offer at Colorado State, had a really amazing interview, and it didn't turn out because they hired somebody that had been adjuncting for them for a while. So that connection thing came back and got me. But Amanda, my partner, ended up getting hired for a post. It was a full-time position, but she needed to get her postdoc hours, and we were prepared to kind of take on the full-time thing. But she was hired at Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. So we moved to Tempe, we moved to Phoenix, and Amanda started her position at Arizona State. And once again, I started cold emailing the faculty there. When we went for our housing visit, I set up a few meetings with design faculty, met with them, got my foot in the door, with no connections at Arizona State, which was lucky. I met a guy named Kyle Larkin, who's really cool, very talented designer, still working there.
is very active in AIGA in Phoenix, and he was super nice, and I ended up becoming, I actually adjunct taught the first semester and worked part-time as a graphic designer for the university, which was challenging for me because it was very micromanaged, and at that time I was used to teaching and doing kind of what I wanted to do creatively, and I wasn't used to having people tell me, like, art direct me, so taking that taking that feedback was really difficult, and I was lucky enough to, I think when they realized that I had some solid experience teaching, they brought me in as an instructor, which is one level above adjunct, for the second semester in the design school at ASU. Phoenix was not really our favorite. It's beautiful in the wintertime. I think I have kind of a negative, I remember it negatively because the first month we were there, I got stung by a scorpion in our house.
Good grief.
I think it was all downhill from there. Scorpions are pretty common in Phoenix. I did talk to a lot of people in Phoenix that lived there their whole lives and had, like, never seen a scorpion, but we had scorpions all over our house. And, you know, they told us when you find a rental house, ask them if it has scorpions or not. We asked them, and they said, no, there are no scorpions. The first day we moved in, there was a scorpion in the bathtub, and we're like, I think we were lied to. But I got stung by a scorpion the first month, and that was really weird. And it was just a big city. The road rage was, like, at level 10 because of the commuting, and it just wasn't really a good fit for us. So after Amanda got her postdoc, even though, you know, she could have stayed on full-time, we decided to make another change. Texas Tech came knocking again. They had tenure-track positions available. they actually sent a recruiting packet. The director there at the time sent a recruiting packet to me in the mail, and it was really a big deal. I mean, like, I was like, wow, I'm, like, really being recruited for this job. And I went to teach at Texas Tech for 2 years, and my spouse got a job as a psychologist and performance psychologist with Texas Tech Athletics, who she still does consulting for today. And I had a wonderful 2 years teaching and a tenure track job at Texas Tech University, and loved my area there, and loved working with the people there, and had an amazing experience. During that time we were in Phoenix, my mom was actually diagnosed with cancer, and so getting back.
Oh, no, I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh, it's okay. It's life, you know. But we were in Phoenix. She was diagnosed. Texas Tech was kind of knocking at the door, and I was like, wow, well, we could be close for treatment and stuff like that. So we kind of made a tough decision to go to Texas Tech again. We did that for 2 years. Had a wonderful experience, and then lo and behold, University of Florida had a tenure track position open, and somebody emailed me about it and said, hey, you should look at this. And, you know, going back to, you know, that year that we had in Gainesville, and really how many boxes it checked. And I think that this kind of is what a bunch of the questions on your list really kind of centered around. It's kind of like the holy grail of what a good position would be like, because A, it's in a place that you really like. We both really liked Gainesville. B, they offered me a position. I didn't think I had a chance of getting a job, so I just put a packet together. I wrote some really edgy stuff and just, like, threw a Hail Mary, because, like, this is a top 10 university. Still, even though I've been out of grad school for 10 years, I still feel like, and I have jumped around a lot, and I, you know, I think because of that, I have a lot of experience and I'm pretty resilient, but I still feel like I'm not there in terms of experience. So I just threw the Hail Mary, and was surprised when I got an interview, and then was even more surprised when I got invited to campus, and was totally shocked when they offered me, and they actually made another hire out of Texas from the University of Houston, me and another person. Oh. And she's awesome, and I've really enjoyed working with her. Her name's Gabi. Maybe you can interview her. But
absolutely, I'm open to it.
So the first checkbox was it's in a wonderful place. We love Gainesville. The second checkbox was that it's a great job. I really like working with the faculty. I knew I liked the students. We knew we really liked the university, the campus culture, the international influence, how progressive everything is. And then they offered my partner a job at the counseling center, which was, we were kind of in shock. Like, normally dual partner hires don't happen at like lower levels. And it wasn't like they offered her the sweet gig or whatever. Like, I was the new dean coming in and they were just going to place a partner somewhere or something like that. But because she had the experience working at that counseling center, knew how to use their client note system and all that stuff, they wanted her. They're like, oh, you're coming back? Yeah, please come work for us because we need people right now. And all the while, we'd been developing a private practice for my spouse in Texas. And so she took a part-time job at the counseling center, and we started building her private practice here in Gainesville. We had to change the name because of a conflict with somebody else that had a business here. So we're working on that now. And I just finished my first year at UF. It was really busy. My program coordinator was on sabbatical the first year, so that spiced things up a little bit. To have two new people and the program coordinator being on sabbatical and basically just one senior faculty. So yeah, it was a busy first year, but my program coordinator, even though she was on sabbatical, she didn't really have a sabbatical because she helped us the whole year and really made it doable. And it was busy, and there were a lot of kind of open-ended questions and tough kind of problems to solve, but she was available the whole year and really made it doable for us. So learned a lot the first year back at UF. So here I am back at the beginning of another tenure process, just finishing my first year. So hoping not to leave here for a bit. We're tired of moving.
Yeah, really. That's seven positions over the past 10 years. That's a lot of moving.
Yeah. And, you know, the moving takes its toll physically. It takes its toll mentally. But it takes its toll financially the most.
Oh, yeah.
That was the biggest deal for us, especially with the, you know, the internships and the adjunct and the instructor positions and the cost of moving. We still own the home in Tennessee, and we were renting it. So we were like renting a house and having to do like maintenance from a distance on it, which was not pleasant. And then we bought a house in Texas too, because we were pretty set there, and it was, I didn't expect that we'd be moving. I didn't expect this to happen. So we just bought a house in Texas. So financially we were really kind of starting to dig out of the hole and get some stability. But when this happened, we decided to sell both of our houses. We sold both of our houses in the same month. Luckily they sold the first day on the market, both of them. Wow. We made enough money to pay off Amanda's student loans, and when my grandfather passed away, he left me his 1989 Winnebago RV.
Yeah.
And, so we traveled in it pretty extensively. So we would actually, when we were in Texas, we would take the RV from Texas down to Florida to a place close to here in Gainesville and camp for 2 weeks. So we were pretty well traveled in it, and we're comfortable living in it and driving it long distances. So we're like, if we're going to do this, we cannot take another financial blow like this. We have to do something dramatic. So we sold our houses, and we lived in the RV for about 6 months. While we lived in the RV, we saved all the money from our paychecks and saved up enough money to buy a house and to live on and really minimize the financial impact of the move. Oops, email. But it was a difficult journey, and it was an amazing journey too. Living in an RV was fantastic. We actually, because we have pets, we have two cats and a dog, we couldn't live in an RV park because they don't allow cats. So we actually put an ad on Craigslist, said, hey, we have an RV. This is who we are. We have these pets. If you have land in or around Gainesville and would be willing to let us live on your land for a while, you know, we would love to pay you if you could let us have our animals or do like land work or whatever. And actually got some really interesting responses and several viable responses. We actually came during the summer before we moved and met two couples that had land and kind of were willing to, you know, to host us for that brief period of time. And we settled on an older couple here that lives just outside of Gainesville, Scott and Sherry Camille. And Scott's a Vietnam veteran, was really active in the anti-war movement after Vietnam. Is kind of a local Gainesville celebrity because of some of the work that he did with like John Kerry and the VVAW after the war, and is still really active locally with like the Sierra Club and stuff like that. And his spouse Sherry helps with that, and they're both amazing people, and they have a beautiful piece of land, and they welcomed us like we were family, and we still play volleyball with them every Sunday. Scott and Sherry have a they have a volleyball court, and we play volleyball with them, and we still go have dinner with them, and they're amazing people. And they would not take our money. We helped them. We helped them with like mowing land, you know, mowing stuff on the land, and we were actually living in the RV on their land when Hurricane Irma came through Gainesville. And of course, by the time it got up here, it was transitioning from a Category 1 to a tropical storm, but if you've ever been in this area in Central Florida, there are just like huge towering pine trees everywhere, which are beautiful, and live oak trees all over. It's just trees everywhere. And, you know, the first year we lived here, those things, they're beautiful, and they're still beautiful. But after you see trees like that falling over when wind blows and like crushing people's houses and stuff, the trees become scarier. So that was kind of our first experience with that, but they actually let us stay in their house with our pets during the storm, and just the generosity of people is amazing. And you know that it was a tough experience to do that, but at the same time, we've met so many amazing people and had so many amazing like resilience building experiences. You know, that have allowed us to kind of get here. So again, you know, like I said earlier, just like so lucky to be in the right place at the right time, and to meet people that care about us, and you know, that I told you it was going to be a long answer to the question. You know, sorry, man.
No, it's okay. That's fine.
But I think that about sums it up.
Absolutely.
30 minutes later.
No, it's okay. So when you, oh my gosh, so many questions. Where to begin?
Okay.
So as you were transitioning from Texas Tech to UF in tenure track positions, did you try to negotiate some years towards tenure at UF, or did you decide, you know what, it's better if I just start fresh here?
I learned a lot about tenure at Texas Tech. Those first 2 years that. That was really my first tenure track position. So before, I was adjuncting and doing instructor or visiting. So I was really kind of, I don't want to use the word shielded from that stuff, but in a way, I didn't have to deal with that. So the first 2 years at Texas Tech, I really learned a lot about how to document things and you know, kind of what to expect out of a process. And, you know, I had really great faculty that mentored me. So, like, you know, I thought maybe it would be a good idea to try to negotiate that, but my intuitive thought was that, well, now that I know kind of what to expect, I think I'd rather start fresh, because I built kind of a good base at Texas Tech, but I felt like it would be better to kind of start and have the full process time to actually kind of build my resume for tenure. So I didn't even attempt to negotiate the 2 years in a tenure track I had at Texas Tech. I do know people that do that, and I know also people that attempt to go up for tenure early, which for me right now, things are happening, but I don't think enough things are happening to warrant going up early for tenure.
Mm-hmm. So can you compare, contrast your time as a visiting professor, instructor, or adjunct versus the tenure track positions? Like, what was different between those two positions? I mean, aside from the obvious, but
yeah, obvious things are going to be, you know, you have service, larger service responsibilities in a tenure track position. Generally, you're paid a little bit more, even over a visiting position. the visiting and the adjunct was much more of a kind of a hands off. You weren't, you know, part of the self-governing process, you know, that the faculty goes through to get things done, i.e. serving on committees and you know, service to the university and stuff like that. It was more just about teaching and having positive interactions with the students and kind of just getting the job done that way. Tenure track position's a lot different because there are a lot of other expectations. So you may be getting paid a little bit more, but there's a much larger expectation for service to the university. There's obviously the expectation that not only do you do research, but the research is cohesive and focused in a way that makes you kind of an authority in a specific area, which for me, that's difficult because I'm interested in so much stuff. And I think that that's really where my interest in design process research as an area of research interest came from, because the process can yield so many different forms, and the experience of the process is what gets me excited about design, and I love to teach. So, you know, I would definitely say the main difference is being a part of that self-governing body as a tenure track professor. You're definitely going to be exposed to politics, and they do exist at almost every university, unfortunately and sadly. And, you know, you definitely have to learn how to work with people that may or may not understand what you do on a day-to-day basis, or like what your field is. And you have to be able to facilitate positive relationships with people outside of not only just your area, but your school. You have to collaborate, and you have to do all this stuff. And I think maybe one of the hardest things is to learn how to manage your time where you actually have enough time to quote unquote do research. You know, I'm sure you've probably heard this before too. Oh, I'm so busy. I need to do my research or whatever. And I feel like when you say that enough times, do my research, like you build up this really weird stigma about, you know, doing research. So when you do get time, you're like, oh, I should be doing my research right now. Well, what is my research? And you have to really kind of refocus on it to kind of start down that path of actually doing work again and getting things published and submitting things to publications. Another thing I've noticed recently and kind of wondered about is why so many conference applications and abstract applications happen during the school year when everybody's so busy. Because I always find myself trying to cram stuff in before deadlines. During the semester, and I'm like, why? And I feel like I'm not submitting the highest quality document because I'm trying to force it. But then again, you know, maybe nobody wants to work during the summer. I don't know. But technically, we're supposed to be doing research in the summer. I mean, that's what I've been told. You know? I guess your podcast is research, so you're doing a good job this summer.
That's what I'm hoping. Yeah, summers are a great time to be able to focus when there's no other teaching responsibilities there.
This is true.
At UF, you just finished your first year there, and have they been pretty transparent about the tenure and promotion process there?
Yeah, I would definitely say my area coordinator has been and is transparent about it. excuse me, sorry. A lot of it's, you know, when you get hired, there's a whirlwind of activity going on. You're preparing for classes, and they give you, you know, the book with the, you know, the handbook with the TNP guidelines in it and the packet. And, mm-hmm. you know, you're like, I'm going to read all this stuff later. And then, you know, classes get started and and you really just kind of have to learn it as you go. But even though our program coordinator was on sabbatical, she was still really proactive in getting us started and letting us know kind of what to expect. There were definitely still a lot of points in time where both Gabi and I, the other new faculty, which I'll say helps a lot having somebody else going through the same thing to kind of ask questions to and commiserate with when things are confusing. But there were still a lot of times where we had to kind of fill in the blanks as to what needed to be done and when, because it seems like a lot of times people just automatically expect that you know when all the deadlines are for things and how things are supposed to work. And so there's some question asking involved. And of course, UF does things a little bit differently than Texas Tech did. At Texas Tech, we had an online system called Digital Measures that we put everything in during the year. It was nice, and we put out it output a report. The report is what the director used to write the annual review in areas of service, scholarship, and teaching. Here it's kind of the same, but there's actually a committee at UF called the FPAC committee, and we put together what we call the FPAC document, which is like it has to fit on 2 pages, and it's all of your activity, you know, during this year. So my first year, it was only a kind of a truncated period of time because I just started. Luckily, had some really pretty good stuff come through, like right when I started, so that helped to go on the FPAC report. But you put together the FPAC report and you submit it, and you actually interview with the committee, and the committee gives you feedback on how to make the FPAC report better, or what's confusing, what needs to be clarified. You have this under service and it should be under teaching, you know, stuff like that. Then you take the FPAC report and you put it in an online system that we have here that's much, much less detailed than what Texas Tech was, but it's another acronym. I can't even remember off the top of my head what it is, but there's a deadline for that too. And if you do a good job with your FPAC, which I really worked hard with my FPAC, and like the first draft of my FPAC that I did, it sucked. I mean, it was horrible. And, you know, I had a really tough interview with the FPAC committee, and I will note that there were no graphic designers on the FPAC committee. So somebody asked me, you know, what consulting was, and, you know, those are, and, you know, while the languages are pretty similar, there are some differences. So not having a graphic designer on the committee to kind of to talk to about that stuff was kind of challenging for me. So I left the meeting really a little confused about some of the feedback because it didn't really fit what I was doing for, you know, research or scholarly activity or even teaching and collaboration. So I actually approached my program coordinator, who was on sabbatical, as I mentioned, and she graciously, like, spent a lot of time with me on the FPAC and kind of showed me how she had done things, shared reports that she had done before, and I actually reached out to another new faculty member in painting and drawing, and she was really nice and showed me her FPAC document and spent a lot of time getting that document right. So when I actually put it into our system for the annual review, the director would see it was really kind of a seamless process, and I felt like I put my best foot forward and squeezed as much out of everything that I did the first year as possible. And I did a lot, both myself and the other new faculty member, Gabi, because our program coordinator was on sabbatical. The other senior faculty member I mentioned is a really great guy, pretty quiet to himself. I like working with him a lot, but he actually, over the holiday break, fell down stairs and shattered his leg and had to have surgery and was out for like a month. So,
jeez.
There was a lot of adversity. So there was all that going on. I ended up taking an extra class in the spring semester to cover the vacancy left behind by the injury that we sustained to our program, and then a few other things. And you know, one thing that I'm seeing more and more on my, and I don't think it's necessarily a good thing for like actually getting tenure, that I'm seeing on my report is this kind of new topic that doesn't really fit in anywhere, and they call it service related to teaching here, and that basically what that entails is collaborations. So there's this, you know, basic, I would say probably it's definitely a university-wide kind of initiative, but at most universities, you know, faculty are you're encouraged to collaborate outside your discipline, you know, on yep. projects and stuff like that. And it's this buzzword and has been for a while. And everybody likes to talk about collaborating and bringing areas together and working in and outside your discipline. And I actually had the opportunity to do that on a few pretty big projects with my students this year. And I've always been good at collaborating with people. And I think that that's why I interview well, because I have pretty good documentation of that. but I did a project with the president's office where we had the president of the university in our graphic design studio, and we had students pitching him projects personally, which was really great. And then I did a collaboration with Computer Information Science and Engineering for a class that they run every year called VR for Good. And it was basically this like semester-long sprint or a series of sprints where teams were put together and they worked on wicked, long story short, they worked on wicked problems and how VR could help in either raising awareness of those issues by experiencing them in virtual reality or actual kind of a utility. Like the project that won was called Virtual Crash Cart. And a crash cart is what a doctor uses in a medic, like an emergency room when they're doing emergency surgery. So like you have to know where everything is in your crash cart. So the VR digital product was actually a crash cart simulation where you could learn about where everything was in your crash cart. It was amazing. So I was able to pair designers in one of my class with those engineering teams, and we did this big event, and it was, there were hundreds of people there, and it was a really cool thing. It was a, can we say bad words on here?
Sure.
It was a shitload of work, and it took a shitload of time. I mean, it took, the president's project was too, because we ended up laser cutting these cards, and we worked with a printer, and these collaborations are good for the university, but they take tons of time and energy. But when you go to write it up on your report, it's like, I spent probably 150 hours on this, and this is not going to help me for tenure at all. It just gets like relegated to this like service related to teaching weird category that doesn't really fit anywhere. But when you're in the moment, you're trying to facilitate good experiences for the students, you know, you're trying to collaborate with people. You want those things to succeed, and you want to take advantage of, you know, like that's the reason we work at big D1 universities, is to be around people that are really good at what they do. And in a perfect world, that's what you want to do. And if I could make one change to the process, and I actually heard somebody else say this the other day, and it really made a lot of sense to me, was I would make collaboration count towards tenure in a way that's more real. You know, if you did a cross-discipline collaboration or something like that, you know, I think the most masterful faculty members learn how to do that in ways that counts towards tenure traditionally. So, you know, for example, we do the VR for Good project or whatever, and then we submit that to a publication or something, and we continue that, and that would you know, fit into more of a traditional kind of publication, like an archetype or whatever, that would count towards tenure. But just the collaboration itself, making the connection, spending the time, you know, there's definitely something to be said on that. One of the things I wrote about in my report for areas, you know, areas for growth would be to be better with time management. And I think that that's probably on every, you know, tenure track faculty members areas for growth list or whatever.
Yeah,
but it's really hard to just turn off the faucet, or I should say fire hose, during the semester, at least like the way it was last year. And adversity happens all the time, and you know, focus on your research. It's tough to focus on your research when, you know, there are other pressing issues. So, you know, those are definitely challenges. And, you know, I think that the tenure process has been around for a while, and it's changed less than a lot of other things have changed in our culture. And I think that it's getting tougher and tougher to kind of define things clearly. There's a lot of gray area, and yes, that's challenging.
Especially when it comes to podcasts.
Yeah, yeah. How's that podcast fit into your tenure? You know, if I get work published on print magazine's blog, does that count as a publication because it's a blog? Or, you know, like, does that count? I mean, I don't know. I mean, one person's going to say yes and another person's going to say no, you know, and probably depends on the area that they're from too.
So far, I have gathered that as long as it is peer reviewed, it's good.
Right. See, that's Neil spinning his magic there, right?
Well, what peer review means, that's a whole nother topic we can get into on another episode.
Yeah. Yeah. We could also talk about contributing new knowledge to the field and what that means.
Oh, yeah. Well, our hour is about up, so do you have any other parting thoughts or upcoming projects that you would like to talk about?
Well, first of all, I want to apologize to your listeners for the long-winded answers to your questions. I hope that it wasn't too boring. Projects to talk about? I guess I could talk about, I'm working on a couple of really interesting projects right now, but I just finished my first mural. A public mural, which was really fun. Never got a chance to do that before.
Where might we see this mural?
I haven't posted public photographs of them really yet outside of just like Instagram stories of like the actual painting process because I just finished them. But they're in Gainesville. They're in a downtown parking garage. There's this thing called the Urban Revitalization Project. And they put out a call and you had to submit an idea and they, you know, they accepted ideas that they liked, and I really found they're all typographic, they're type based murals. I actually did unexpected. They look way different than most of the other murals, which are like dragons and fire and, you know, like people with crazy faces and stuff like that. But mine are, I was channeling my inner Ed Ruscha or Robert Montgomery, I guess, two artists that I love, but they're all type-based. I actually did an exhibition in Knoxville, Tennessee at RALA, Regional and Local Artisans, who I love. They're great people. I did a First Friday exhibition there. I had a collection of writings, just short, you know, one or two sentence thoughts that I have called Black Velvet, and I had about 30 of them, and I had two or three that really kind of stuck out to me. That were just experiential writing based on kind of what's happening in life and culture right now. Mm-hmm. Really observational stuff. A lot of very similar to what I did with my thesis project at University of Tennessee, where I developed a writing practice and I created illustrations based off the writing practice, and it was very process oriented. Black Velvet is very process oriented, and I like to create these series, like these collections of work. I call them series over time. And so I chose a couple and submitted them. And so the murals were a lot of fun. I'm working on a series of posters right now that address the gun control debate in America. Social justice oriented illustration and poster work. It's a very traditional graphic designy thing to say. But that's like that's another tough thing, kind of have like a two-prong approach to research, which is kind of tough. You've got the experiential process stuff and then the social justice initiatives with illustrative work and poster work. I'm working on a series of prints that are traveling in an exhibition and actually screen printing those posters right now. And I still do some letterpress too. So keeping the hands dirty. But I'd say the murals were fun. It was new. And I did another project that was social justice oriented that we'll have to talk about it another time. But I actually got to make graphics for NFL helmets, which was also very exciting.
Yeah.
So yeah, not to be used in the NFL, but like regulation football helmets that are worn in the NFL, where I did these fake teams for these helmets and created this thing called the Hall of Shame, which is kind of a parody of the Hall of Fame, and actually had people vote, which was, again, very experiential. You know, try to tie it all together. That was a really fun project too. I like the self-initiated experimental stuff. I like being in an experimental place. Honestly, like I do enjoy working with clients, especially clients that, you know, there's a mutual level of respect between designer and client and designer. But really where I get most excited is being in an experimental place. And that's another great thing about teaching and working at a university is that kind of thing is encouraged. And I really appreciate that. So
thank you again for taking time out of your day to be on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Nils. It was a lot of fun.
Well, I hope to see you soon at the next conference.
Yep. Yeah, I hope we cross paths again soon.